Okay, well, good evening, everyone. And welcome to LSE for this public event. My name is Simon Dietz, and I'm Professor of Environmental Policy here. This event is being co-hosted by the Department of Geography and Environment and the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment, in no particular order. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker, Professor Scott Barrett. Scott is the Lenfest Earth Institute Professor of Natural Resource Economics at Columbia University, and he's also a centennial professor here at the LSE. He was previously at Johns Hopkins University and before that at London Business School. He's been a visiting scholar at many leading universities either side of the Atlantic, and he's a fellow and former chairman of the advisory board of the Bayer Institute in Stockholm. His books include Environment and Statecraft, The Strategy of Environmental Treaty Making, and Why Cooperate, The Incentive to Supply Global Public Goods. Scott has received several prestigious awards, including the publication of Enduring Quality Award from the Association of Environmental and Resource Economists. See, Scott, I said I would embarrass you. And the Eric Kemper Prize from the European Association of Environmental and Resource Economists. He was made a Fellow of the Association of Environmental and Resource Economists and received an honorary degree from the University of Bath. He's played a variety of roles in the policy arena, including lead author of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, lead advisor to the International Task Force on Global Public Goods, and member of the World Health Organization's Strategic Advisory Group on Malaria Eradication. And last but not least, he received his PhD in economics from the London School of Economics. So today, Scott will be discussing climate technology treaties and the energy transition. For Twitter users, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Climate. This event is being recorded, and hopefully, it says hopefully here, will be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. As usual, there'll be a chance for you to put your questions to our speaker after the lecture part. But for now, I'm delighted to hand over to Scott. Scott, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks, Simon. I don't even know what Twitter is, but I'm going to see if I can turn this on. Isabel, do I have to do something? Just push it.
Not that.
Oh, it's working.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you so much for coming. I'm really excited that so many people are here. I've been working on climate change for over 30 years. I actually started just a little bit when I was finishing my PhD here in the late 1980s. And then it's become an obsession. And I have felt for a long time that from the beginning, that the approach we've taken to address climate was the wrong approach. You know, it's a funny thing. When you understand the logic of what we've been doing and you see all the earnest and intelligent and well-meaning people dedicate their lives to it, it's very hard to see anything else. You can only kind of see what's in front of you. If you've ever been to one of these so-called COPs, the conferences of the parties on climate change, there are literally tens of thousands of people at these meetings. And everyone's oriented towards the script, essentially, that's been written. It was actually written a long time ago. And what I'm trying to do is imagine a world that actually followed a different script and whether we might have ended up in a different place. And this is, I think, the advantage you can have as an academic. There are disadvantages, too. I'm not denying that. But I think, in a way, the ivory tower sometimes can help you to see things more clearly because you're not always, it's not working. Move it up.
Yeah.
Is that better? If I tap it, does it like, it's like a dog, does it respond?
Is that better? It is?
Okay. Should I hold it? Okay, I'll hold it. So I can't wave my hands then. Just one. All right. So I think there's an advantage when you can step back, and you're all here at the LSE. That's what you're doing here. It's such a great opportunity to see the world before you get thrown into it, because when you're into it, you're just hit by so many different things. It's very hard to see as clearly. So I'm going to try to share this view I have. And I think the world's also coming around to adopting a different kind of approach, almost by stealth. And so I also want to talk about that. All right. So what I'm proposing basically is a new approach. And I'm going to be drawing from things that are already happening. But what I'm trying to do is provide a kind of a systematic way of looking at what we have been doing and what we are doing now and what I think could be more fruitful. And if we understand, if we can see that roadmap, as it were, if we understand that framework, I think we could be more successful. So that's the purpose. What we've been doing is focusing on emissions, first of all, at the level of the whole economy. So we can speak of Britain's emissions or Germany's emissions or Japan's emissions and so on. And that's been the focus. If you look at all the climate models, that's, of course, what they all look at. You're adding emissions, it turns into concentrations, blah, 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 blah. So it makes sense from a top-down sort of way. But what I'm going to focus on is not the economy, but sectors. Also, we've been looking at what countries are doing on their own. So what's happening in, you know, what's the U.S. doing? What's China doing? What's Malaysia doing? And so on and so forth. Okay. I'm going to be looking at global change. Now, when you focus on countries, you want to add them all up to get the global. We all know that. But what I'm saying is, let's focus on each of us playing a role in transforming the entire world into doing things differently. Not the way we've been thinking about it. Okay. Third, the instruments that we've been focusing on, targets and timetables, all the climate treaties are always about that. And again, it kind of makes sense if you've read the climate models. That's kind of an input to the models. And then economists advocate economic instruments like cap and trade and carbon taxes. I'm not going to be advocating any of that. I'm focusing on technology and fuel standards. So a very technical approach, a very different approach. And finally, we've been looking at incremental emission reductions. And now, because basically we haven't achieved much for a very long period of time, people are saying we need to go to zero. Well, we always needed to go to zero. But now it's everything is pressing because so little has been achieved for so long. So now the focus is on zero. The focus on zero really helps. Because when you're focused on zero, you spend a lot of time about how to transform every part of an economy. So it's not, where can we do it? Where can we reduce emissions most cost effectively? It's not about that anymore. It's about how do you transform an entire economy? And of course, I mean the global economy. So what we're looking for is what I would call transformational change, not incremental change. It means you have to change the system. By the way, just the word system is very important. It's not about the parts, it's about the whole system. That's what we need to transform. Okay. And a real critical insight to understanding the approach is we talk about emissions. No one controls emissions. And no one wants emissions, by the way. You don't say, hey, I'm aiming for this for emissions. What people want is services. They want heating, cooling, lighting, motive power. That's what people want. And to get those things, we combine fuel with technology. Okay. So what I'm saying is, instead of looking at the byproduct of that, the emissions, let's focus on the complementary fuel and technology. Because maybe we have more leverage over reducing or changing those, thereby to change emissions, than we do by going for emissions directly. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Of course, one reason for focusing on a new approach is that the old one hasn't worked very well. This is a a kind of picture. I've been using it for years just because I love it. I update it all the time. This is time. This is CO2 in the atmosphere measured at Mauna Loa in Hawaii. These are actual readings from the air. The red are the more or less daily observations, and the black would be a kind of an average over time. And I've added the green vertical line. That's my artwork here. And that stands for when the negotiations began. So basically, to the left is before the negotiations, and to the right is after. So I would just invite you to look at that picture and then tell me, do you think the negotiations have made a difference? Okay, now look, I'm at the LSE, you people are super smart, so I know that. We can't tell by looking at the picture, because it could have been that without the negotiations, this curve would have gone, you know, way up here. So actually, maybe we just did a lot of great things and we spared the world from, you know, even worse climate change. But I think if you leave your, you know, just for a few seconds, you know, park that part of your brain, which is correct, and just look at it. It's hard to look at that and think, hey, yeah, we've been really successful. Okay, we're going in the wrong direction. So I think it's really critical just to see, we've been trying to negotiate for over 30 years, and we've not succeeded. Okay. Here's another way to look at it. Okay, these were pictures that were shown in Sharm el-Sheikh at the latest COP. We've had 27 COPs. Makes you think if we had 27 more, we finally get this right. I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. So here are actual emissions. This is COVID. We came down. Yeah, it's gone right back up again. And these are the declarations that were made. This is right after Paris. These are the intended nationally determined contributions. So this is just a error bound of where countries thought they could go. And then they revised this over time, and it's gotten a little better. But this is where you need to go if you want even a 50% chance of staying within 2 degrees C change. Okay, even 50 degrees change. 50% chance of success, as it were. These are the actual emissions going back to 1750, the start of the Industrial Revolution here in England. And that picture, I think, is really important because we're part of this system that has brought development to the entire world, mainly due to fossil fuels. It's stunning. And now we're saying, that was a mistake. Well, it was okay for a while, but now it's no good. We need to change. And we need to take this incredible path with all the momentum behind it, all the capital infrastructure that was all built for a world relying on fossil fuels. And we need to change that. And oh yeah, we need to do that by 2030. I mean, it's pretty amazing. I hope you feel some awe in looking at this, of what that challenge is. It's amazing. We need to reverse a trend that's been going on for 250 years. That's going to be very difficult. So that's the challenge. Okay. If you look at some of the policies that have been tried, including the kind advocated by economists, British Columbia, province in Canada, has a carbon tax that has been much celebrated. And there was an analysis done on it recently that calculated that it reduced emissions 4% in manufacturing. I mean, that's not going to transform the planet. The EU ETS, though, that's the most ambitious policy of its kind anywhere. It's amazing. It is a great achievement. But a study of the ETS estimated between 2008 and 2016, it reduced emissions 3.8%. It's amazing. All that work for 3.8%? It doesn't seem like it's right. And the Kyoto Protocol, which was the big first effort to get the world to cut back on greenhouse gas emissions, a study found that it reduced emissions by the richer countries 7%. But if you take into account the effect of trade, which I'll come to in just a second, the Kyoto Protocol has had, at best, no effect on worldwide emissions. So what's going on behind that? You're getting some countries to cut back on emissions, but what that's doing is it's changing world prices compared to the world where they didn't do that, and that change in world prices is causing emissions to rise elsewhere. So one group of countries tries to do the right thing. Prices change, you can't stop that, you can't prevent that. And then other countries do something, they go in the opposite direction. Okay, that's why those two things are canceling out there. So I asked the question, you know, is this the right way of, is this the approach you want to take to get to zero? I mean, it hasn't even gotten us to reduce emissions against the historical trend. Is it going to get us to zero? I have my doubts. Okay. So what has worked? All right. I got this picture last night. This is the way I see the world. This here is the path that the architect of the park designed. This is where everyone should be walking. So this is like the COP. It's a great idea. But this is what people do. They start going off somewhere else. I use game theory in my work, and this is how I understand game theory. You just have to learn just to watch people and what they do. They're telling you something. So what I'm asking here is, maybe we achieved some things that we weren't achieving on the straight path. Okay, so one of the good things that's happened, that was never part of the plan, as it were, is never part of the negotiations, is that the price of solar photovoltaic cells has come down dramatically. You can see here, on the horizontal axis, you have cumulative installed capacity, but you also can see the dates, maybe, if you have good eyesight. So it starts 76, 77. So as time passes, the prices are coming down, but also as the capacity expands, prices are coming down. And that's reflecting a phenomenon that I think is really quite important of increasing returns. So what's happening is people are learning better how to make the photovoltaic cells, how to use them so they are able to capture more energy, how to manufacture them, and economies of scale, all of that kind of thing. And that's what's bringing the prices down. And a study was done to look into the impact of those different components, and it found that R&D alone was responsible for about 60% of the fall. Economies of scale, 22%, and learning, just learning how to make them more cheaply, 7%. The prices have fallen to the point where the International Energy Agency now says solar PV is becoming the lowest cost option for electricity generation in most of the world, which is expected to propel investment in coming years. So that's amazing. By the way, there's a limit to the penetration of solar or any renewable energy, because you need to store the energy. It's not, solar and wind is not going to make the energy available exactly when you want it. Okay, so all by itself, it's not sufficient, but still, this is pretty remarkable. And in contrast to the leakage I mentioned before with reducing emissions, this leakage is negative, meaning, may not make sense to you, meaning that when the price of solar PV falls, other countries want to use more of it. So therefore, they're going to reduce emissions. So why don't we just think of this from the beginning? Like, why, instead of, if we go to reduce emissions, you're changing prices, other countries increase emissions. But if you reduce the price of solar, everyone wants to use more of it. Fossil fuels are worth less generally. Emissions are going to come down. Okay. But this all happened by people veering off the path. There was no treaty behind this. This is just reflecting decisions, including on that R&D, which again is the biggest component of the fall in cost. That R&D was driven by things like the worry about the first OPEC price shock from early 1970s, when particularly Japan and the United States spent a lot of money on coming up with substitutes for fossil fuels. So it's basically reflecting a whole history of investment that really had very little of anything to do with climate change. Okay. Another one is batteries. and particularly the lithium-ion battery. And you see I have a similar kind of a picture here where the cost has fallen dramatically, 97% since 1991. Again, here you have installed capacity, but you also can follow the dates, and over time, the prices are falling. Again, another study was done of this, 54% of this fall is due to R&D, 30% to economies of scale, and 2% for learning. So, pretty similar picture as for solar. At the same time as prices have fallen, the energy density has improved, which means that the same amount of storage can be in a more compact form, which is why you know our phones can do so much more and they even get smaller over time. That's what's basically going on, and we can use that in automobiles and for storing electricity as well. So these are two really good things that have happened. Another thing is we actually do have a really good climate treaty, and it's not the one you're thinking of. There's a treaty called the Montreal Protocol, which was negotiated in 1987, the intention being to phase out chemicals that destroy the ozone layer. Well, it happens that those chemicals also are greenhouse gases. Ozone itself is a greenhouse gas. And the substitutes are, many of them are greenhouse gases. So it's kind of a complex story. But the long and short of it is, a good scientist from the Netherlands has done the calculations. He estimates that the Montreal Protocol, which was intending to address a different problem, achieved four times as much for climate change as the Kyoto Protocol intended to achieve and didn't. So would we try? It didn't work. We didn't try. It worked. Okay, so I think that's going off the path, and you want to see what's going on there. The story of what's going on, now I'm going to show you this picture here. This is the kind of the LSE component. I'm going to show you a bunch of pictures like this, so I need your attention to make sure you follow these. There's going to be basic geometry, and there's a basic logic, and I want you to understand that, because I'm going to show you a lot of other versions of this. Okay, so this is a simple game. There are 10 players, for this particular picture, there are 10 players in total, and you're one of them. And you ask yourself, what should I do? And this way this was set up, should I pollute or should I abate? You take as given what everyone else is doing. And on the horizontal axis, you have the number of others who are abating. So if on the far left, no one else is abating, you ask yourself, should I do it or shouldn't I? Well, the way I've set this up is that if I pollute, I end up here, which is pretty much where we're all starting. If I abate, my payoff, this is a payoff here, so you think of it as like a profit, falls. Why? Well, it falls because, yes, I'm addressing the environmental problem a little bit, my part of it, but I'm paying the cost of that. And the way I've, by assumption, the way I've set this up is there's a loss, which is often true, by the way. I'm going to show you other pictures. But, of course, the reason this is an issue is because we know that if none of us acts, we're all screwed because we need to solve the problem. So what happens is if you reduce your emissions, you go down here, but everyone else reduces their emissions too, then you benefit from all of their actions. And you're not paying for their costs, you're only paying for your own. And now the payoff is really quite high. This is actually the best you can do right up here. This open circle. So this is the tendency of where countries are going to go, because no matter what others do, you're always better off yourself polluting. You know it's stupid, by the way. It's not like you don't, but it's still hard to get away from the fact that self-interest is something that we're talking national self-interest. It's something that drives me. It's not the only thing. But it is a powerful motive behind behavior. And there's no other way you can explain certain things, like why countries meet to say we have to act on climate change. They all agree, and then they go off and they don't do what they said they were going to do. I mean, I don't know how else to explain that. Okay. Do you know what this game is called? Oh, come on. I know you do. This is the London School of Economics. It's the most famous game. Prisoner's Dilemma. Okay. It's a little bit of a caricature. Real world is a little more complicated. I understand all that. Okay. But nonetheless, there's something quite powerful behind this. I think we need to understand it. So this is telling us we're here. We're not doing very well. We know that. We want to be up here. We're all going to be much better off if we are. But how can we get up there? Well, in a way, one way to think about this is, well, I would do it if I could only trust the others to do it. By the way, this is the kind of thing you hear from the negotiators. Okay. It's their fault. I would have done the right thing if I could count on them to do the right thing. How do you build in that kind of assurance? Well, normally you do it, like you would do it at the level of a nation state, by having laws and the power of enforcement. But you don't have that. We have laws, but you don't have a centralized power of enforcement at the global level. So you can rely on treaties, which are like contracts, but the treaties can't be enforced by any kind of enforcement branch at the international level. So instead, you have to rely on self-enforcement. And that's a severe constraint. But it's the reality. This is the world we live in. So what I'm proposing is a way to get around it. Not to just complain about it and, you know, wring hands, but get around it. We have to think strategically. Okay. So that's this other picture. And this is how the Montreal Protocol did it. So what happens to the Montreal Protocol is countries are being asked to phase out these chemicals, but they're also it's also part of the treaty that the countries that are in the treaty won't trade with the countries that are outside the treaty in all these CFCs and products containing CFCs, including cars and things like that. Well, what the trade restrictions do is they change the incentives quite dramatically. So if no one else is reducing emissions and then you do, now you really suffer. I mean, this drop is bigger than here, because you now not only bear the cost, and you only get a little bit of the benefit, but you can't trade now with the rest of the world. So that's a big loss. So that's why you're so much worse off here. But if you go to the other end, and everyone else is in the agreement, and you're out, well, over here, you can benefit by free riding, right, by moving up here. But here, you're actually, if you leave, you're actually worse off. Why? Yes, you're free riding, but now you can't trade with the rest of the world in those products. And that could be a big loss. So what happens here is now pretty amazing. With the Montreal Protocol, every country is in the agreement, every country. Every country has complied fully with the obligations to phase out the chemicals. The problem they set out to address is being addressed. Everyone's up here. And that agreement is under no strain at all. It works. So the international system is able to achieve things, but the way to get countries to achieve things is to offer them to play a game that they're good at playing. What we do instead with climate, we tell them to play this game over and over and over again, expecting a different result. What's that called? I think it's called insanity. Because we've never figured out how to enforce an agreement to get all countries to reduce their emissions. We haven't figured that out. Okay. All right, so that's basically what's behind Montreal, and I'm going to extend that idea to other areas for climate. We do have an amendment to the Montreal Protocol called the Kigali Amendment. It was negotiated about 9 months after Paris. And it reduces the emissions of hydrofluorocarbons, which are a substitute for some of the CFCs. They don't destroy the ozone layer. So really, the Montreal Protocol has no business regulating them. But they are a greenhouse gas. They were included in the Kyoto Protocol, but the Kyoto Protocol failed with them. Okay. But this one is going to succeed because they're also adopting these trade measures. That's what's different. The thing about the trade measures is not that they're trade measures. Don't think about that. It's because the trade measures in that agreement transform the game. Without them, you get this. With them, you get this. This is what's critical. So it's not just the trade. So don't, when you hear people talk about trade, you know, let's link trade, just be careful. This is what we want it to do. Here, everyone's in, everyone does what's required, trade is never restricted. I mean, it's like perfect. You get all the benefits of free trade, and you get all the benefits of protecting the ozone layer, which we have done. That's successful. Okay. And the Kigali Amendment, this red area is a projection of what would have happened to temperature change if without the Kigali Amendment. So you see that temperature would have increased by, you know, three to five tenths of a degree Celsius, okay, by 2100. Whereas with it, it's all going to level off and be pretty much where it would have been if we didn't use the HFCs. So this is projected to be another success. And if it does what all the other 98 or something chemicals controlled by Montreal did, it'll succeed. Pretty cool. One other thing about this. There are 147 parties to this treaty. One of them will surprise you. One of them will surprise you. I was waiting for this to happen. Here I am talking about technology and I can never get it to work. Isabel, do you know what's going on? Come on, I had this ta-da moment, and then... okay, good, thank you. All right, so this is a statement from President Biden. Yes, the United States of America is a party to this treaty. And by the way, you probably never read about this anywhere. I mean, when things go right, people never see it. They never talk about it. It's quite amazing. Okay. Now, to get a treaty passed by the United States Senate, you require a three-quarters majority. When you hear all this insanity about the United States, often that's about a much smaller majority, and still it's completely insane. But you needed 66 senators, at least, to get this to pass, and they got it. And so over 20 Republicans voted in favor of ratifying this treaty, including the leader of the Senate at that time, Mitch McConnell. Wow. Now, what does that tell you? Yes, there is insanity in the world, okay. But maybe that's not the only problem we have. Maybe the problem is we're always asking people to do the wrong thing. And if we ask them to do the right thing, they'll say yes. I'm not advocating insanity. I'm just simply saying, it's pretty cool. Something good happened despite that craziness. Okay, so there are these two different approaches we can take. The traditional approach that everyone's been focusing on is reducing emissions. I'm going to call that the direct approach. I mean, it makes sense. The problem is emissions. Let's reduce the emissions. You get this phenomenon called lock-in, and that makes reducing emissions that are very small, like 3%, 4%, 10%, pretty easy, but it makes bigger emission reductions harder and harder. Lock-in means that you've got investments over very, very long periods of time in infrastructure, including embedded within that infrastructure the knowledge of how to make these things more cheaply, better, and so on and so forth. And all of that is already embedded. It's locked in. And now the new kid, as it were, comes and wants to get in here and push out the old one. And that new kid doesn't have any of those advantages because it hasn't had many decades of, or even centuries of R&D. It hasn't had all that investment. It's very hard for it to penetrate to get in there. That's the lock-in problem. Emission reductions, as I just explained, is a prisoner's dilemma. And enforcement's very difficult. If enforcement were easy, Kyoto would have worked. We would be wrapping it up. That would be what we'd be doing. I wouldn't be giving this talk. I never thought that could work. It hasn't worked. The new approach in Paris is basically a voluntary approach. That's not going to work either. It may achieve something, but it's not going to achieve enough. Now, the technology switching approach is indirect. So in a way, it's kind of dumb. Like, we want to reduce emissions. What are we talking about changing technologies? Well, when we change technologies, we may, as a consequence, change emissions. That's why it matters. You still have lock-in, but if you have increase in returns, like I showed you for solar and batteries, where as you expand capacity, that horizontal axis, and costs fall, that's going to help adoption. So more and more people, companies, countries are going to want to adopt those technologies. So lock-in is hurts you quite a lot for switching technologies when very few others do, but increased returns helps you at the other end. If a lot of others are switching, all of a sudden you want to switch. And one way to think about this, we're looking now at, we have internal combustion engine, we're using petrol, and then there's, or here I guess, diesel a lot, and then you have the electric battery. Well, imagine that most people are driving electric cars. Well, then you have recharging stations everywhere, but it's pretty hard to find a petrol station. Well, then it's like, oh my God, and then you can't get parts for your car, and so on and so forth. Well, there's a penalty then. So right now it's hard for the new guy to come in, but once you get a lot of penetration, it's gonna be the other way around. It's gonna be harder for the internal combustion engine to survive in that kind of market. Technology switching can be a tipping game. That's what we had there with Montreal with the trade measures. That's what you can get with vehicles. And enforcement here is built in. In fact, it's so cool. People have been wondering, what do we do about making sure that countries don't revert to using fossil fuels in the future? Well, here's a simple solution. If you take liquid fuels and petrol, if everyone's using battery electric cars, the demand for gasoline goes to zero. And no one's going to want it back. So that, you don't have to worry about that anymore. It's like, it's such a, whereas other people are talking about, we have to keep raising the carbon price. You don't have to do that. Okay, so it's a different way of seeing it, but it's helpful. Okay, so now I warned you, I'm gonna show you more pictures. All right, so here's the Perseus dilemma for countries that are gonna choose their emission reductions. Obviously I'm making this very simple. I'm assuming all the countries are symmetric and so on. The reason I do that is just because doing it differently is difficult. I mean, it's you can't, I can't show you a pretty picture. Well, okay, this is not so pretty, but it would be, I'd show you a bunch of numbers, it wouldn't mean anything. So this is, I'm only interested in our thinking. All right, so this is the payoff you get if you do what's best for you. Now, what's best for you, no matter what the other's doing, is not doing nothing. That's a total misunderstanding. You will want to do something. The thing is, you won't want to do that much. So there's a concept called the social cost of carbon, it's SCC, which is basically the price, like the damages that a country experiences due to an emission of CO2. Well, there's a global value, which is the one that people are almost always talking about. And we don't know exactly what that is. The Biden administration did new calculations. So under Obama, it was around $47, $48 per ton CO2. Under Trump, what do you think it was? Well, the cool thing is it wasn't zero or negative. It was actually, it wasn't five, but it was just over a dollar. Okay, so 40-something with Obama, one to Trump, but not zero. And then with Biden, what do you think it is now, the new one? It's 190 or something. It's over 190. Okay. I have no idea what it is, by the way, but I tend to work more in terms of ideas than in numbers. So that's the number down here, the global number. The national, but if you have a global number, then that's adding up the social cost of carbons that each of us have as individuals, and we're all citizens associated with a country, and you have these national numbers. William Nordhaus at Yale University, who got a Nobel Prize for his work on climate, has, you know, he's very bold. So he will not only do these calculations, but he'll do them out to two decimal points, which I personally can never do that. I just don't have the, you know, I blush too easily. But he did this calculation, this was in 2017 in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The global value he had is $30. Don't worry, it would be higher today, but let's not even talk about that. That's the global value. But he also calculates it for individual countries or regions. And for the US, you had just under $5. For the EU, just under $5. Anyway, what I'm saying is, this is what a country would want to do just for its own self-interest. It's not zero, it's positive. But it's lower than the global one. That's the key thing. So going back to this picture, that's why abating to the global level doesn't pay off for the country, because it's not getting those benefits itself. But it does benefit when other countries reduce their emissions. So the best thing they could do together is that everyone adopts the global social cost of carbon. But what people tend to do, or countries tend to do, is they adopt just their national one. So you're going to see action at the domestic level, but it's always going to be too little. It's not zero. Don't even look for zero. It's always going to be too little. Okay. Now, with technology switching, what I'm looking at here is a zero-emission technology. So this is the old technology, so it's the same as here. If the first country switches, the cost is really high. It's actually much higher than over here. And that's because now they're having to bear all these costs of being the only one, no increase in returns yet, the only one to incur this incredible cost. There is, however, an extra benefit, which is that's zero emissions. This one over here is not going to reduce emissions to zero. Okay, and these curves here are a little steeper than there, because as another country adopts the new technology, the benefit for the others goes up even more because you're getting more emission reductions here than over here. Okay? But the way I drew this, and I could have drawn it differently, but the way I drew it was the best you can do here would be everyone switching to this technology. But notice that the payoff you get here is actually worse than you would get here if all countries adopted the global social cost of carbon. I could have drawn it differently, but the main point I'm trying to make is when you have what are called constant returns of scale, meaning if you want to double abatement, you have to double all the investment to achieve the abatement, therefore you're doubling costs, these two curves are always going to be parallel. So they are here with emission reductions. They are going to be here with the technology switching. So there are two reasons why technology switching doesn't help. These curves never cross, like they did with that Montreal case with the trade measures. And also, this payoff is actually lower than over here. Okay, but what I want to look at is when you have increased returns. That's when things really change. So with increased returns, now you get this yellow curve. It's much steeper because as more countries adopt the new technology, the cost for everyone else to adopt starts to drop. And the more they do it, the more it drops. And so this curve is quite steep. And now it crosses this other curve. So over here to the left of this dashed line, the payoff to sticking with the old technology is better than switching to the zero emission technology. But to the right, it's the other way around. Everyone wants to switch. Switching is better for your self-interest than not switching. So your self-interest is driving you to do what's in the interest of everyone. That's what you want. That's cool. This is a tipping game, and this is the tipping point. I'm calling it K-tilde. Okay? That's with increasing returns. Now, you can also have a situation like this. So now I've had the payoff to using the old technology decreasing. That's because I'm assuming here that, you know, the example I gave you before with the petrol stations, when they start to disappear, having an internal combustion engine starts to become less attractive. Parts are more expensive, all sorts of things, it becomes less attractive. So this payoff is sticking with the old technology is falling, but the payoff to moving to the new technology is rising. You have another tipping point, but the best you do here is now not as good as you would have with the global social cost of carbon, but here you don't need enforcement. Once everyone has switched to the new technology, no one wants to go back. And here, everyone's always going to want to cheat on that agreement to set the carbon tax equal to the global social cost of carbon. So that's going to be a harder decision. How do you sell this one rather than that one? You have to understand the logic behind this to actually be willing to go for this one. All right, that's really important. So that's why what I'm trying to do is sometimes interpret what it is we're seeing so that we see what's going on behind it instead of just seeing it as a fact. Okay. You can also get a cascade, meaning that the tipping point could be as low as 1 or 2 or 3. It could be really very tiny. And a cascade is when one country switches, and by doing that, it lowers the cost to the next country switching, and then that country switches, and then because two of them have switched, the cost falls even more for the third one, and you get this bandwagon effect, okay, or cascade effect. Here's one example, the best example I can think of, actually. I've spent some time thinking about this. It's not one example, it's the best example. the entire world, this is kind of cool. Again, this is the kind of thing, like this, you don't read a newspaper article about this. The entire world in my lifetime switched where everyone in the world was using internal combustion engine with leaded petrol. And today, no country does. That's cool. So again, something worked. Why did it work? You had a cascade. So what happened is you had early, in the early 70s, you had regulations by Japan and the US. They were all focused on local environmental problems, not global, okay? But when they started to reduce the use of unleaded and of leaded petrol, and the United States also wanted to use a catalytic converter, which basically reduces other emissions from vehicles. And that became integrated within the car. And then you have economies of scale in car manufacturing. You have economies of scale in oil refining. And all of this, by the way, I first understood this living here in London when I was reading The Independent, which was my favorite paper at the time, a long time ago. And I read one of those little tiny articles they publish on page two, you know, the little ones that, like, in those days they used to do this. And there was a little article that said Sudan was going unleaded. Well, at the time, Sudan was having civil war. It was a total disaster. I'm thinking, what? Sudan is going unleaded? Why would it do that? 10 minutes? Thank you. Why would it do that? Well, I looked into this. The reason it was doing it was that it was an exporter. So it had refining capacity, and all its customers basically wanted unleaded. Well, it's complicated to make unleaded for one group of customers and then leaded for yourself, and that's an example of increasing returns. So basically, what happened was, even though unleaded is more expensive to make, you have to add things to it, you get, when everyone wants the unleaded petrol, you get the economies of scale and the price falls. Spot prices for unleaded were cheaper than leaded. So you don't need a lot of encouragement to switch because the economics are just your self-interest. It's just making you want to switch. Okay. Anyway, so what happened is you started off with a total ban in Japan in 1986. Again, everything originally began in the early 70s. The United States came later, even though it was one of the first movers. UK, China, blah, 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 blah. And finally, Algeria in 2021. So the world now is totally off of lead in gasoline. And lead in gasoline, you know, lead destroys the brains of little children, literally. So their IQ will be permanently lower for their entire lives. So it's a nasty, toxic chemical, and it's good we've gotten rid of it in petrol. So there are some good things we've done. And that happened without a treaty. I wonder whether we might be seeing something like this going on right now with light bulbs. In particular, you may know, well, you do know, I'm sure, that the EU has phased out incandescent light bulbs, the old-fashioned kind, and also compact fluorescent. Compact fluorescent used to be the one you would use to save energy, but actually they're not that efficient compared to the newer light bulbs, the light-emitting diodes, the LEDs. They're much more efficient, and they've really improved over time, and that's a solid-state technology, so you can actually do all sorts of cool things with them. So all of a sudden, they're not just providing light. They can do a lot of other things. The long and short of it is you've had a lot of countries ban those light bulbs, the incandescent and the compact fluorescent and halogen, which are kind of incandescent. And this picture here from the International Energy Agency shows you how the penetration of LEDs has really grown. Okay, and it looks like it could possibly take off, and you might have a situation like we had with lead and unleaded petrol. Okay, and that's happening. Market forces combined with governments wanting to have things like lighting
cheaper, you get lower emissions, but also you use less energy to produce the
lighting. And it pays off for the individual consumers, even if they don't always see that, because it's a higher upfront cost, but it lasts a lot longer, and it uses a lot less energy. So we might be seeing it there. Some cases it's harder. Now, with electric vehicles, I go to Norway fairly often because, you know, I'm into saving the world, so I get invited to Sweden and Norway fairly often. I'm not going to mention countries that don't invite me, but even my friends, academic friends in Norway, have electric cars because these massive subsidies. And an economist has calculated the implicit cost of getting this switch in Norway for electric vehicles, 1,370 euros per ton CO2. That, whatever the social cost of carbon is, I think almost everyone would agree it's less than that, and probably many times less than that. So this is like a massive subsidy. They're incurring a big cost. Remember I said, well, if you're the first country to act, that cost, that payoff is really going to drop because you're bearing the full cost. Now, they're helping the rest of us. I mean, it's a little tiny market. It's Norway. I mean, but still, they're helping the rest of us by moving first, okay? But because of that, they're going to have trouble getting others to follow. So what you need to do, not just get Norway down here, right? This is this big drop in payoff shows you how difficult that is. But how to get, what you want to do is get everyone past here. So this is getting the majority of the world to move over here. That's harder. That's what you need to do. That's that big push in the title that we need to achieve. And then the real question is, well, how would you do it? Because we can't necessarily rely on cascades for everything. So what you want is incentive for countries to switch because they believe a lot of others are going to switch. So where does that belief come from? Well, we're seeing something now with a number of countries banning internal combustion engines, which is pretty much opening the door for electric vehicles, maybe hydrogen in some places, but pretty much for electric. And you are seeing an increase in sales from electric. So from 2020 to 2021, sales doubled, and the share of total automobile sales increased from 4% to 8%. I mean, that's good. It's amazing. At the same time, you know, 8% is a lot lower than 100%. There's a long way to go. And you think about the move from leaded to unleaded petrol, how long that took. And now people are saying, okay, we're going to do all of this. Not just one country, like one Norway, that's okay. It's a small country, but think about all the resources that are going to have to be used to produce all those cars and batteries for that big switch all at the same time by 2030, 2035. That's pretty impressive if it happens. Well, you could have a treaty that will get you past this point. I'm not saying we need one with electric vehicles, but it is an idea we need to be thinking of and using. I'll give you another example where I think it's very relevant. And the treaty would be written very simply, and this is what treaties are good at. All countries that are parties to the treaty must switch, but the treaty only enters into force if at least this number join. This is how, every treaty is written like this, but here with this tipping game, you can see what's really going on. Because if the others don't join, you have nothing to lose by signing because it doesn't apply to you anymore. You're not bound to meet it. And if enough others do join, you positively want to meet it because your payoff is higher when you meet it. So that shows you how just a very simple way, a tiny little, you know, it's a big push because you're moving from here to here, but in a way it's a little kind of a tiny one. It's you're talking about writing a paragraph in a treaty. It's that simple to get this kind of switch. Okay, now can we do better by linking with trade? The short answer is yes, but remember, it's not just any kind of linkage on trade, because everyone's got a different idea of what they're talking about with trade linkage. The only places where we've seen trade used so far has been through by focusing on sectors. Like the most recent example was the EU Aviation Directive, when European Union was going to bring in international aviation into its ETS system. And then China and Russia and the United States and India all threatened massive retaliation. And then EU said, oh, okay, we're not going to do that. It's a longer story, and the outcome in a way, I think we haven't even seen the full outcome yet. But nonetheless, it can be very difficult, particularly to move on your own. Okay. There was, back in Glasgow, there was one good thing, in my opinion, that happened, which was, at that conference, which was that the US and EU together made an announcement that they were going to negotiate trade measures for aluminium and steel. Okay, and what I liked about that was they're not going to just do it unilaterally, although two of them, that's not exactly a large multilateral agreement, but nonetheless, and again, they're focusing on a sector. Well, with trade linkage, remember, Montreal included this, right? So we know it can be helpful. It can transform the emission reductions game and the switching game with constant returns of scale, but only under very limited circumstances. thing is, when you have increased returns, even when they're pretty weak, the trade is just giving it an extra push. And that can make all the difference. Okay. Oh my God. do I want to go through this one? Let me do one of these. This is the main one I want to look at. Okay, so these white curves, even I'm getting dazed by them. The white curves, this is the prisoner's dilemma you have in switching. You have very weak increase in return. So this is the payoff to using the old technology. This is the payoff to using the new. There's always that gap, and so no one wants to switch. So everyone ends up down here. But when you add the trade measures, what happens is, if no one else switches and you do because of the trade measure, you're now much worse off because you can't trade with the rest of the world. Okay, but as more and more countries join, your payoff to not joining, to sticking with the old technology, falls relative to without trade because now you can't trade with the rest of the world. And over here, that fall gets to be pretty big. So these curves cross. What I'm saying is, so here, the trade measure combined with increasing returns gets you that tipping situation. The other pictures are showing that it can help or it may not help in other situations. So the details are going to matter. I'm trying to give the big impression, but always, you know, understand. You have to look at a lot of the details to know what you should really do. All right, here's an example, aluminum. So the US and EU want to impose trade measures. Basically, they're thinking of some kind of carbon border adjustment mechanism. They got trouble agreeing, by the way, for a lot of reasons. And I'm not a big fan of this approach. But I am a big fan of using trade, but using it differently. Remember in Montreal, it's the threat of trade measures that causes everyone to cooperate. So trade is actually not disrupted. And we need a situation more like that. It's not because I'm timid, that's not what I'm saying. It's that you don't need the trade measures because everyone's doing the right thing. But if you hadn't threatened the trade measures, they wouldn't have done it. Right? It's a little bit like nuclear deterrent, although I don't want to get into that. Okay. So they're going to be looking at something like CO2 emissions from steel, or the US is interested in looking at energy input. I would propose a different approach. When you make aluminum, the smelting process, we use now an anode to make the aluminum, and I'm not the world's expert on this, but the anode we use is a carbon anode, and it results in CO2 emissions and emissions of perfluorocarbons, which are another greenhouse gas. If you replace that carbon anode with something called an inert anode, those emissions go to zero. Now, there are other emissions for the energy, for electricity, for the aluminum manufacturing. So there are other emissions, but this one is such a simple one. It's a drop-in technology, and you could devise a treaty that said all parties to this treaty must produce aluminum using the inert anode and only trade in aluminum products with countries that are party to the treaty. So you're limiting where trade is, and what you're basically doing is providing incentive for countries to switch to the inert anode, which is not a super complicated process, okay? Easy to verify, it has a lot of attractions. It reduces emissions. Perfluorocarbons, we've had trouble reducing. This reduces them pretty quickly. Okay, it's not gonna solve the problem, but what you have to do is look at pieces and then how they add up. Another approach we could take is using R&D. What R&D does is, remember R&D was the most important thing behind the drop in battery and solar prices. What it does is it makes switching cheaper. So this payoff curve to being the first one that switches moves way up. So now the loss you experience is a lot less. And in this picture, what happens is you start up without R&D, you have a prisoner's dilemma, no one's gonna switch. With enough R&D, you get a tipping game, and now you have a tipping point, and now you have a problem that the international system can actually solve. I'm almost done, so that's good. It's almost a miracle, Simon, but okay. Okay, and an example of this, something I discovered recently that is pretty cool. There's a thing called Mission Innovation that was born out of Paris. It includes 24 countries now, including the big ones. of most of the big ones. They're focusing on individual sectors. So this is what's happening. You know that path that was kind of going off? This, this cop thing that goes, this is the path that goes this way. This is one of the cool things going on the side. You know? And just looking at one sector, shipping, they're looking at other sectors too. They have three goals for 2030. They want to have at least 200 ships that will use zero emission fuel. They want to scale up production of the new fuel so that it's available. And they want to modify the ports so that those fuels can be supplied, the major ports, so about the 10 large ports worldwide. What's underpinning the whole thing is innovation. It's that R&D push, because right now it's not known what is the best fuel for international shipping. And you can see this here, right on their one of their papers. Innovation is needed for the transition to zero emissions. Okay, this is a really intelligent approach because they're thinking about the need for shipping. So one approach that looks pretty good right now, of course this could always change, is using ammonia as a fuel. And you've got to produce the ammonia using renewable energy, taking nitrogen out of the air, using electrolysis to take hydrogen out of water, and then using synthesis to produce the ammonia. And this could be used as a fuel. This is an example of a ship that's using it now. And that's the old kind. This is the old technology. This is the new technology. You want to get that kind of switching. I looked at the biggest ports in the world, and the ones in orange here, so these are the biggest ports in the world by size. Shanghai's the biggest, and so on and so forth. The UK doesn't even show up here. The orange are the parties to this mission innovation. Okay, so it looks like they have enough of the big parties that they could make this work. I doubt if 10 ports is enough for tipping, but I mean, the logic of it is correct at least, and they could always increase that, right? That's 10 by, what was it, 2030, whatever the year was. So I see this is strategic. This makes sense to me. And you don't get this kind of discussion going on with the big climate conferences. So the main points is my last slide. This is a relief to the chair who knows what I'm like. And okay. The UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, that's the COP system, has failed. You know, I love it. It's not that I want to like criticize it. It's not, I know they're all trying to do the right thing. I've been part of, you know, involved in it myself. It's basically failed. I mean, just look at those CO2 numbers. That's what I mean. It asks countries to play the wrong game. It's really that simple. I started off by saying, you know, you watch all these, everyone talking about we need to reduce emissions, we need to get this, we need to do that, and you just can't imagine anything different than that. You're just swamped by it. You're overwhelmed by it. You can't see anything. And actually, we could have done it very differently. A focus on technologies and fuels rather than emissions can be more effective if you have increased returns. If the increased returns are weak, you can supplement them, bolster the process with trade measures, strategic R&D. Strategic meaning you're doing the R&D not just to lower the cost, but to bring about the tipping. That can be transformative. That's very different. And the essential need is to transform the prisoner's dilemma game into the tipping game. Let's stop asking countries to do what they're bad at doing. Let's start asking them to do what they're good at doing. Thank you.
Okay, Scott, thank you so much. So now we can open the floor to questions from the audience. I'm going to take two or three rounds of questions. When you ask a question, please can I request that first of all you give us your name and tell us who you're affiliated with, and secondly, please do formulate it as a question rather than a speech. Okay. So with that, let's take some questions. So immediately I've got a hand up in the corner there, we'll get started there, and then I'll take two or three more questions before we'll deal with them together.
Thank you. So my name is Julia, I'm a third year here at Geography of Econ. So Simon, I was taught by you last year that we prefer cap and trade and taxes over standards because of dynamic efficiency, the double dividend, et cetera, I could go on. So I wanted to ask how you both disagree on this matter And I want to sort of ask, where do you see the role of innovation if we're only using standards and if we're not really incentivizing firms to innovate? Or at least that's what I've seen so far from the economic approach, that if you set a standard, then you don't have the incentive to innovate. Whereas of cap and trade and taxes, you do. So maybe I'm missing something, but I'm interested to hear your opinion. And second very short question, you talked about the trade mechanism with regards to the Montreal Protocol. Isn't that exactly what CBAM will be trying to do in the EU?
No. Okay, thank you. Very perceptive question. So we've got a hand up near the front here, the gentleman here.
Hello, can you hear me? Yep, I'm Charles. I'm just in the visual attendance to the meeting. But you did mention about the lack of efficiency towards the EUA or EU ETS system, and you did point out statistics that like a limited effect towards the carbon prices, in fact, towards the reduction of emission. But you did sort of use the era that the price was at its lowing point while the EU ETS was trading constantly below a single digit. During that time period between 2016. And also, you are promoting a lot of sector-based microeconomic approach towards, you know, the tipping point, while kind of underestimating that the market design of higher energy prices, higher EU ETS prices, affect towards pushing the entire system push towards the tipping point. Would you be able to elaborate why are you focusing on that?
Thank you. And we'll take one more question. So if I go all the way to the back, if that's possible, I see a gentleman there with a grey or white shirt, right in the back row, in front of the clock.
Good evening, Adam. I'm a pessimist, but I'm going to try and ask an optimistic question. What initiatives or possible developments are you most excited about in the coming years in this space? Just to try and have a happy note. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I think we'll do some answers or reflections now, Scott. I've got some notes. Happy to help you if you want, but.
I'm definitely going to need help. I didn't get your point. So it was not your fault. I was just kind of like, so I asked you to rephrase, but let me start with yours. Two great questions that kind of like, you know, hit us. Like, that was great. I love them. The first is, and I think, Simon, I think you should join in the answer. No reason why we should agree. You know, why? I think the first one was about why not, you know, economic instruments are supposed to be great. Well, they are great. They're cost effective, blah, blah, blah. So they have all these nice features to them. The main thing that's driving everything I'm talking about is the need to do this at the global level when you do not have centralized enforcement. Because if we had centralized enforcement, I would say, yeah, let's do that. By the way, even if we had centralized enforcement, theorems that support the use of the economic instruments, they are assuming things like, they're not looking at things like increasing returns. So that is something, it's another thing that has to be taken into account, okay? But the main reason I'm not looking at that kind of instrument, and I don't think that kind of instrument is helpful, is because you can't enforce it. So what you'll see is you'll see a lot of countries using a low carbon tax or cap and trade with a relatively low price. But again, they all have a private or national incentive to do that. And what you're not gonna see is the transformation we need, okay? You also made the point, and I may have missed part of what you're saying, I apologize for that, about innovation. Because people say, well, if you use the economic instruments, you're stimulating, providing incentives for innovation, which is true. By the way, if your prices are low because you can't deal with the enforcement problem, you're stimulating minor innovation, okay? It's actually not the innovation we actually need. But economists, and I am one, are normally quite critical of technical standards. So they will, I think this is what you were getting at, but they will say, well, you know, governments shouldn't be picking winners, and also that once you pick a standard, it tends to get locked in and it doesn't get replaced. All right, so this is, you have to drop your ideology and just look at the world as it is. I'm interested in one thing, what works. I don't care about anything else. I don't come in here with any kind of, I just want to know what works. Okay. So if you look at the setting of these technical requirements, look at the Montreal Protocol, looking at Eugenie Dugoa, who studied this so much. You started off with that treaty phasing, cutting in half, something like a dozen chemicals. And then over time, and then you went to 100% total phase out. And then you added more chemicals. So it wasn't as if that was something that was just locked in. In fact, under that process, by the way, an industry is involved in this. They should be involved in this because they're the ones that make this stuff. They know what it takes to make it. Now, there's issues of trust and incentives, of course. But nonetheless, this is not just a pure political question or a narrow political question, rather. So there would be a substitute that would be better than the existing chemical, but not perfect. And then the industry wanted to know, okay, if we make this, which is the best available now, will you allow us to recoup our investment on that before telling us to move on to the next one? It was that kind of dialogue. And that's why you had this progressive improvement over time. So that's one example. Another one, which is about a technology rather than a chemical, is over shipping. So I showed you this switching shipping. Shipping is regulated through the International Maritime Organization. It's actually based here in London. It used to be, well, let's give one example. It used to be that there was this problem of ships, the oil tankers would take on oil and flush out their tanks to put in ballast water, which would then be mixed with the oil. And then when they release those into the sea, they're deliberately releasing oil into the sea. That was the biggest, by far, the biggest source of oil pollution worldwide. And what they did is they just devised a regulation to separate where you put the ballast water from where you put the oil. And then you would have thought, okay, well, having done that, those tankers are already built. There's no way they're going to change that, right? They changed it because the new threat, once they dealt with that problem, the new threat were accidents. So then they required double hulls, and you had to put the water ballast tanks on the outside. That was the double hull. So if you get a rupture, you're only releasing seawater at worst, right? So I think you do get innovation with standards. And I think that they have a strategic, everything I've been saying has a strategic advantage because we do not have centralized enforcement. If we had centralized enforcement, then I would be in favor, apart from the increased returns does add a ripple to everything, but I would be in favor of using the economic instruments.
Okay, so we had a, so one of the things that I got from your question, it would have been a question I would have asked myself, actually.
Okay,
the examples that you chose of carbon prices having relatively small effects on emissions were drawn from places in the world and times when carbon prices were very low and by designing these schemes were very unambitious.
That's true.
So I guess the question is, does that mean that carbon pricing can't work? If we look at the EU ETS right now, the price of an EU allowance has been close to 100 euros at times.
Yes.
So
absolutely. No, that is absolutely a great question. It's absolutely true. It will be, I'd love to see what the effect is going to be. And of course, that's what someone mentioned, the carbon border adjustments. I mean, that's another reason for having those, is to try to put more and more of the industrial sector under the ETS. So I think that's very fair. I would just go back to my point that when you don't have global enforcement, generally speaking, I think the EU ETS right now is different. But when you don't have global enforcement, those prices are all going to be pretty low. I mean, the Canadian tax, what is it now, $30, something like that. It's British Columbia, which by the way, I mean, almost entirely hydro. And so this is just cars, basically, is what it comes down to. So you're going to have the levels are all going to be too low everywhere because you're not dealing with enforcement. So that's the remember, that's the thing that's driving everything I'm saying, is that worry about enforcement. But I do agree, the EU ETS now is so high, it's a bit like Norway, you know, adopting the promoting electric vehicles with this very high implicit social cost of carbon, over $1,000. So yeah, so the ETS price is getting up in close to 100. That should make a difference, particularly if people expect it to last. For investment, you want to make sure it's going to last. It's been very volatile historically. It's gotten very low, so it's bounced around a lot. All I can say is, let's see.
And then we had a question. The question from the back was,
initiatives the pessimist.
Excited about.
The pessimist. The pessimist wanted to know if there's anything good. I thought I was giving all this good news, so I'm upset. Well, I'll tell you something I didn't mention. I'm not a pessimist, I don't think, but I'm, what am I? I think I'm like, okay, I've got two parts of my brain at least, and one is kind of idealistic, and the other is okay, realistic, I would call it, which some people may interpret. But I think I've got both, and they're fighting each other all the time. One thing that I'm concerned about, I didn't mention, but I will mention it. So this is more in the pessimism category than the optimism. And that is that things have really changed. So not only are you getting all these initiatives that are pretty exciting, but the atmosphere is changing. One of the changes is very positive, because people are looking for solutions. I love that. That's the focus on getting to zero. That's terrific. But another part's very negative. And that is that policies are being designed with a view not just to cooperating to solve a collective problem, but also to getting material advantage relative to other countries. So you have industrial policy, trade measures being used not to solve the collective action problem, but to bring resources home at the expense of other countries. You saw the reaction to the Biden, Inflation Reduction Act, which is the climate bill, which has a lot of measures in there that favor domestic production, which is going to be costly, by the way, which is going to hurt solving the environmental problem. But I think more generally, you've got this problem with lithium. You need cobalt for these batteries. You need silicon for producing the solar photovoltaics. These minerals, now they're going to have to be produced on massive scale. And that's going to introduce new problems. I think there are all sorts of reasons, and the world is kind of right now not in a very cooperative mood. I would say, generally speaking, there are exceptions. I think that is actually a potential problem, and I'm concerned of this kind of linkage about getting national advantage as opposed to, in my case, I'm using it to achieve a collective goal. So I am actually, that's the side that I'm more worried about. I've worked on climate, I mentioned, for over 30 years. One thing about it that's always amazing is that it's always changing, and I never understand it. So I'm just amazed. I was like, how can you work on this for so long and not understand this? Because it's I'm constantly being thrown off balance by all sorts of different things. That's the latest thing. So there's kind of this mood thing right now. It's pretty positive in some ways, and also kind of there's a dark side to it that I find a bit worrying.
Okay, we'll take one more round of questions, take two or three questions. We've got one over on this side, just conveniently in front of the school.
Hi, I'm Bella. I'm in the MSc Environment and Development Program here. In terms of the Inflation Reduction Act with the expansion of the 45Q tax credit, the cost for carbon sequestration, well, carbon capture, I think just changed about $135 a ton. And for direct air capture, about $180 a ton. Do you see this type of pricing as something that'll be realistically continued, or perhaps more so like a path forward?
Okay, thank you. I'll go over to the other side. I've got about three rows back, I think. Yeah.
Hello. Does it work?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Alexia. I'm from the School of Public Policy. And my first question is, let's imagine that there is a international agreement, as you suggest. Then how does each country implement the agreement at country level? How does it bring the private sector along? And then I have a second question, which is on the scale. So I do understand that it works best, the approach works best when it is an agreement at a global scale, but would it still achieve a meaningful impact if it were only, let's say, with European countries and a few other countries that they trade the most with.
Okay, thank you. I'll take one more question, which I'll take from the middle. So the gentleman there. And so if I could kindly ask you to ask a one-part question, just because we are going to run out of time.
Thank you so much. My name is Hamza, and I'm doing MSc in Urbanization and Development from LSE. So I don't have an economics background, but what I could understand to, you know, we have to achieve this tipping point by global cooperation. But if we have to do this, then will it not be the case that some developed countries will have a head start and more advantage over some developing countries? And will it not exacerbate the already existing social inequalities in the developing countries? Thank you.
Thank you. A great round of questions. Well done, you guys. And over to you, Scott.
LSE is amazing. It's true. Your questions are really great, every single one. Thank you so much. And thanks for your stamina. First of all, the Inflation Reduction Act. So there are these prices for carbon capture and direct air capture. Direct air capture is something I'm particularly, I think can play a very significant role. That's taking CO2 directly out of the air and putting it somewhere so it doesn't get back up there. And you can do things with it too. You can take it out of the air and then make fuels with it. A lot of different things. It's pretty amazing. And actually, it's the only backstop technology that exists for climate. It's really quite a significant technology. I think your question was, so the incentive, so I don't remember the numbers, but the incentive you said for, I'll just say direct air capture, $180, but that number does vary depending on whether you're using mainly domestic inputs to this, labor and so on, than foreign. So that's where that industrial policy, it's all over that bill. Now, you know, in a way, that, you needed that to get it passed. I mean, this is the United States. I mean, it's not a functioning democracy right now. So, you know, I mean, even at the best of times, any democracy, you know, you have to, you know, perfection is something that, you know, is the ideal. But you need to get the votes. But anyway, leaving that aside, your question was whether that value having been set, whether it would continue. Am I right? Yeah, right. Well, that 180, I'd just say, given that the social cost of carbon that the administration calculated is maybe a wee bit higher than that, you know, that's, so there's a logic behind that. But also what they're trying to do, and this is, I think, pretty conscious effort by the Biden administration, is they understand at least that they need to have transformations in technologies and that they need to have investment. So you've heard about the Prince William and all his, they have this, what's it called, the Earth Shot, or what's it, something like that, what's it called?
Earth Shot Prize.
Well, of course, he gets a lot of publicity. The United States has the Earth Shot program, spends like billions on it, like not like the Prince thing. No one wants to go to those events, by the way, but the Prince thing, everyone wants to go to that. They did the last one in Boston near me. Everyone expected I was going to go there. Like, no, I'm not part of that crowd. So they have this, and the logic behind that is very consistent with what I've been discussing here. They actually want to do the R&D so that they can lower these costs. And I think that, yeah, they actually have one on direct air capture. And I think they want to bring it, I can't remember exactly, but maybe it's to bring it under $100 or something like that. So in other words, you would expect you'd have to offer a high reward initially to get that R&D, which is ultimately going to bring down the cost. And you also want to demonstrate you can do it at scale and all those different kinds of things. So if it worked, that price should come down anyway, because you wouldn't need that big of an incentive to get companies to keep doing it. But there's always the worry with Congress, of course, that something that was adopted could be repealed or not renewed, and that's a perennial problem with all legislation. But there is a logic behind all that that's pretty impressive, and that's coming through executive orders, not through the legislation. A couple of minutes, okay. Okay, so Alexei asked a question about action at the country level and the private sector. You know, one thing that's very important is that the private sector is the one that's going to do a lot of this, and I think they should be involved not in obstructing, but in solving the problem. And again, Montreal Protocol is very successful in that. There's some really cool things going on. I mentioned electric light bulbs. All the major manufacturers are switching to LEDs because they see the advantages of that. So there's no opposition. It's not like Exxon Mobil saying, we're the best in the world at solar. They're not, and they're not going to be. So they're holding on to their oil, and they're fighting for it. But when you see the focus on technologies, and they see that everything is moving to a new direction, they're all going to be following that. So I think that's a good model. That's a positive thing. And then the last one, about developing countries. Yeah, very important. So developing countries, yes. So again, there's this kind of this negative thing going on right now about competition and so on, and countries trying to get advantage. Developing countries, so one thing is my approach is different from that, because what I'm saying is there should be an agreement, and issues like fairness and so on should be handled within the agreement. So you use things like trade measures by agreement. They're not imposed by, like, I'm going to tell you what to do, and if you don't do what I want, then I'm going to stick you with this. It's a different logic. Just be really clear about that. I think there are these issues of fairness. On the other hand, they're serious issues. But on the other hand, developing countries have things on their side too. I mean, one is they lack the installed infrastructure that it's a funny way, it's an advantage, because the lock-in shouldn't be as much of a problem. What you don't want, what neither developing countries nor richer countries should want, would be for developing countries to grow, like China has, for example, like the rich countries did, and then have to change everything later on. It's just better to do it all earlier. So I think with resources, yes, developing countries can be exploited, for their lithium deposits and that kind of thing, but also they can have for the sun, for solar and so on. So I think it's going to be a mixture. And I don't think it's going to be necessarily helpful nor harmful, because it's been a problem anyway, but definitely something that's very important to integrate. So very, 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 very critical question you asked. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Okay, so that's, relax. Good. I'm relaxed. So that is all the time we've got tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us, but most of all, thank you.
Thank you.